fast. Okay, and let's do this thing.
All right.
Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in again to another episode of the BAMF Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, and today we have convened a year-end gaming and comics roundtable to talk about who is snickering.
I'm sorry. I just have to turn my head, and I saw the infamous Mark Sanchez of the New York Jets butt fumble. My bad. Sorry. The butt fumble gets me every time.
And that is Christopher McLaughlin of Green Ronin fame. How you doing, Christopher?
I'm apparently already wrecked the podcast, so I'm highly, highly regretful right at the start.
You spent a lovely amount of time watching the butt fumble, Chris.
Well, how can you not?
Doesn't that happen to you in class, Chris, when you're trying to talk and introduce something and one of your students just cuts up and messes everything up? Does that ever happen to you?
You know, the really good and bad thing about my class is somebody is cutting up and drawing things off topic. It's usually me.
Okay. Well, I'm taking it back as much as I can for one second and introduce the rest of the guys we have. Sitting next to Chris on my little Skype window is Jason Tondreau.
Hey!
Hey, Jason. You might know Jason from Dr. Comics at blogspot.com. He's also a great RPG writer who's done a lot for Vigilance Press, and he's helping us out with Stark City.
Yeah, I hope I get to do more. It's been a lot of fun.
Cool, man. Glad to have you in. I guess is it okay if we talk about that thing you guys are doing for Fate Core?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's been no secret. When we get to it, yeah, by all means.
Okay, cool. And Adrian Smith of Mesozoic Press, who's also a great artist who helps us out at Fate and Go. How you doing, Adrian?
Pretty good, thank you.
Appreciate you joining us. I know it's, like, way the hell late over in the UK.
So it's still midnight early now. It's fine.
You're still a young man, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I was in bed at 9:30 last night. I was like, oh, man, I'm old. And last but not least, Steve Henson.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, Steve. So, hey.
The man who needs no introduction.
Apparently.
Yeah. The godfather of superhero role-playing games, mutants and masterminds, icons, but everything else you can want to think of, Steve Henson.
And you took control of over icons again. And
I did, yes.
It's very exciting for everyone. It's brought huge new enthusiasm to the line.
Yeah, I'm very glad for that.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, Jason, thanks for the perfect segue.
Hey, it's my job.
Let's talk about the Great Power Kickstarter.
Yes, Great Power Kickstarter has been going for a couple of weeks now and has hit all but, at least last I checked, all but one of its stretch goals.
That's wonderful.
Thank you. You know, I'm very pleased with how it's going. It's been very enthusiastically received. And so we've got hundreds of backers who've got their hands on the playtest draft and are no doubt pouring over it.
Yeah.
And Dan Houser is hard at work when he's not doing art for Stark City, working on concept art for Great Power. So we got a lot of stuff in the works.
Are we looking at a second edition or expanded core rulebook for that?
Well, that's one possibility for icons at some point down the road. Great Power certainly fleshes out a lot of the superpowers side of things and you know, makes some refinements to different powers from the core rules and adds a lot of additional ideas onto that. So the possibility of you know, an updated edition is certainly, you know, something that has been considered.
So one of the things that makes icons distinctive from, you know, your other superhero role playing game is that it's so much simpler. Do you feel like was there a risk as you were writing Great Power that you were adding too much complexity to the system?
I was very conscious of that, and I tried as much as possible to not go that route. You know, there's certainly always a desire for more detail.
Yeah.
You know, I hear a lot from, and I'm even hearing it in some of the playtest feedback of folks who would like more of something. I think that with icons, I try to resist that urge as much as possible, just in order to keep the game relatively light.
Yeah.
In terms of its approach, and not you know, overburdened it with a lot of material.
Now, when you made icons, it very much read, and I thought that the random character generation fit into this, as kind of a pickup superhero game.
Yeah, that was the idea.
Okay. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. The initial idea behind icons was a game that you could just sit down and roll up a group of characters and play.
Now, do you see it as evolving away from that into more of a campaign-style traditional RPG, or do you still see it as essentially a pickup game?
I'd still like to keep that character of the game. There's clearly more demand for more, shall we say, more robust gameplay options. And, you know, I probably will try and support that as much as possible. Again, it's one of those areas where a lot of folks have wanted things that I think might be better served by other games, frankly. Like, you know, a refinement of the point-based character creation system that I put in as kind of an appendix for people who are just positively averse to the idea of randomly creating their characters. And a number of people wanted to see a more refined version of that system, and I'm really not inclined to do that just because there are a number of games, and frankly, I already designed one, that do that with a lot more detail.
Right.
So as of, right now, 5-11 Mountain Time, you are $6,435, and your next stretch goal is $605.
I was going to say, about $65 away.
Yeah, not far at all. So, I'm not putting you on the spot, but any idea what the next stretch goal would be?
The next stretch goal is pay Steve a living wage.
Don't shoot the moon here, man.
Honestly, some of it is going to depend on how it is, but I don't want to burden the project with too many stretch goals. I think that if your Kickstarter is runaway on fire and you literally just don't know what to do with all the money, you can definitely come up with some more ambitious plans than your initial modest idea for the product. Great Power has hit a lot of the ideal things that I wanted to be able to do. I can afford to pay someone to do the layout who's not me. And so I got, the great opportunity to have Daniel Solis do layout and make the book look really good. I can afford to pay Dan for as much art as the book needs rather than having to, kind of moderate my art budget. And I can afford to do a few extras like the GM screen and to pay Daniel Gallant to update the icon's character folio. But really beyond that point, I'm hoping to, make a small profit off the whole process as well.
Madness you speak. Yeah.
I know. It's crazy, but if I can actually make enough money to justify the amount of work I've put into it, then who knows? I might be inclined to actually do more of these game products.
What's now I'm curious what that number would be, but that'd probably be rude to ask, right?
Well, I set my absolute minimum right from the beginning to set aside enough to feel like I wasn't wasting my time, in order to actually put the book out there. I'm definitely not, I am still paying myself out of the initial money from the Kickstarter. But let's just say that, I initially was charging myself less than my usual working rate. So
you need a better agent, man.
I really do. The negotiations with myself broke down really quickly, and I just gave in way too fast. We'll see. If it turns out in, the final days of the Kickstarter, as it sometimes does, it really picks up again and starts, really picking up steam, then, that might be, the time to look at some other stretch goals, and there are some definite ideas you know, that we might do. But, you know, I also don't want, you know, a lot of times it seems like Kickstarters, people with the stretch goals get away with them, and they end up promising a lot of stuff, especially for, you know, and I think it's great that people get some really great bargains, you know, with buying into support a Kickstarter, but, you know, it also has to be, you know, done with an eye towards profitability and, you know, this is what I do for a living, so.
Yeah, otherwise a year later you're writing them a really email about how you get really depressed and couldn't get stuff done and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about.
I just heard this can happen sometimes. I don't. Hey, Chris McLaughlin, save me. Talk about what you're doing for Mutants and Masterminds.
Yes.
Well, I'm working on a secret project and where, you know, I would be beaten and tasered and vanished to Cuba if I talked about it openly. So the one I can talk about, though, is, of course, is our well-publicized and extremely well-funded Kickstarter project, which is the 10th anniversary M&M rulebook, which, much to my surprise, hit the last of our stretch goals, which involved me. You know, I had no doubt that this thing would get fully funded, but, you know, when you're the last stretch goal, you know, you really have to think a lot of yourself to just go around thinking, yeah, that's in the bank. But yeah, we actually not only raised that money, but surpassed it. And that really hit, that was an early Christmas present for me. Just the fact that the fans have enough faith in me and what I could add to it to pony up that much extra bucks for it. So,
I still think it's because you promised the apes.
The monkey.
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, people who will sort of half know me and come up as they wander over to the Green Ronin booth at cons, and they'll say, "So what have you done for M&M?" And I'll say, "Well, you know, there's my scholarly breakdown of the themes of Golden Age comic books and Golden Age." And they're going, "Nah," and I go, "I did that one adventure with the superhero monkeys." Yeah,
who's that guy?
You're him. Yeah, so. Not that I'm complaining, but you know that just seemed to be such an obvious thing to do given my history with this game, and I'm also contributing a short essay about what it was like to write the first adventure for it, and that alone is feeling me bringing back some more memories and great thoughts, you know, that of all people on this earth, that I'm the one that was blessed enough to do M&M's basically version of Keep on the Borderlands, something that I came up with. So,
well, I especially loved the fact that Chris's idea of an intro adventure for Mutants and Masterminds was, so the entirety of creation has been destroyed.
Well, the reason for that is something I think Steve can sympathize with. Steve and I were both veterans of working on the West End Games DC Hero license.
Yeah.
And that company had just Humanoids, who had bought up West End, they gave up on the DC license, and we had three or four books in various stages of completion that were never going to come out.
Yes.
And we were in that brief time frame before Hero Games came back and Pinnacle did Brave New World and things like that. And it really, really, really did look like, you know, the surest ticket to exiting the game industry was to put out a superhero game. And I absolutely love Steve's design, and I thought it was a great, great game, but, you know, me loving a game is certainly no guarantee of its ultimate success.
So you figured you're going to get an adventure.
At the time, you know, I did not automatically assume like superhero game equal having a future. So I figure, you know, if I've only got one shot at writing an adventure for this game, I'm going to put in everything I love in between these two covers. And so, yeah, we started with the end of the world.
I like that approach. I think it's just swing for the fences starting out. I don't think you need to, like, build up to stuff. That's just me, though.
That's not jokes. Before the podcast started, we were talking about some of our favorite writers, and Chris, you mentioned Jim Starlin. That's exactly how Thanos was created. Starlin had his first job was writing a single issue of Iron Man. And he didn't think he'd ever get another shot, so he put in every character he could think of. And they were all rip-offs of the New Gods, of course, but he knew that. So, and that's what we got Thanos. It was exactly the same. He figured, well, I only get one. I might as well shoot as big as I can shoot. And it worked out.
Oh.
Just one last second apart to you, dear listeners. It's fuck the late gratification. Just go for it.
But it's so great to be able to come back after 10 years and have the opportunity to revisit those scene those themes, especially in such a high profile project as this. And you know, and then of course we got Emerald City coming out next year. So you know, it's like it's not only still around, but it's reinventing itself for the future now. And it looks like we'll be doing this for a long, wonderful time to come. And what a wonderful blessing to be able to do that in any field of endeavor in this crazy life, eh?
Yeah.
So, Emerald City is coming out when?
Emerald City is scheduled for, I want to say late in the first quarter next year. But I don't have the schedule right in front of me. I know we're moving ahead with production on it, so I would certainly think it'll be first quarter next year.
Sweet. That's going to be the box set, right?
Yes, Slipcase.
Slipcase.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sexy. Okay, cool.
Yeah, Slipcase with, I want to say, 3 books.
Nice. Okay, cool.
Should be pretty nice looking. We're actually seeing some of the art, final art rolling in, and it's looking really good. The cover, by the way, is kick-ass.
Now,
it's really nice.
Forgive me for asking a stupid question, but what is the basic difference between Emerald City and, say, Freedom City?
Well, the way I like to explain it is if you think that Freedom City is basically the microcosm of the mature comics universe.
Sure.
I particularly use the DC universe, although there's a lot of elements. And Freedom City is everything Steve likes in comics in one, you know, one package. But you can think of Freedom City as sort of the mature, you know, comic book setting, one that has a really long history.
Yeah.
There are all these legacy characters, there's all the story, and, you know, superheroes have been around there forever, all of that stuff. So there's tons of characters, there's tons of history to it. Emerald City is more like Marvel's Manhattan in 1963.
Okay.
It's a city that is up and coming, you know, I mean, it's become this, you know, sort of new economic power in its region.
Yeah.
But has been sort of quiet and sort of overlooked and not a lot, you know, and we deliberately get into the backstory why, not a lot of superhuman activity there. And then all of a sudden, boom, one day, the Silver Storm happens. There's this big event and all of a sudden all hell breaks loose. You've got all of these people with superpowers. You've got all of these new heroes and villains. Emerald City becomes the focus of this world-shaking plot, and you're off to the races.
And so there's more of a vacuum for the player characters to fill.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they get to, especially if they play through Emerald City Knights, the first adventure arc,
right.
They basically get to be Emerald City's home team. They get to be the ones who, right from the beginning, are the ones who are solving this crisis, who are the people Emerald City and their authorities turn to for help. You know, so they're the ones. You know, they're the ones who get to start it all.
Well, that sounds very exciting.
That's kind of like what we're doing with Stark City.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, speaking of Stark City, I think everyone, all the backers know, but in order to accommodate some time to make sure we get the conversion to the Great Power rules done, we're going to be pushing back delivery till February.
Right.
So just FYI. Mm-hmm. Considering releasing the setting rules early, this is kind of a show of good faith to the backers. But
I can't imagine that a Kickstarter project would actually publish on time.
Well, there's that.
In prepping the fails has been pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, you just had a new release today, didn't you?
Oh, well, thank you, Steve. Yes.
Indeed, yes.
And Adrian Smith did the art and the layout for that. That was Return of the Crimson Frontier, written by Dan Houser and Christopher Hurd. It's kind of a John Carter of Mars homage. It was one of the adventures that our backers voted on, actually, from a slate of possible adventures. And it's available now on RPG Now for just the measly price of $2.50.
And it's got a terrific cover, too.
Mr. John Gibbons did that.
And, it's an amazing cover. The actual lettering in the back as well, because it's a nice piece of artwork. I'll bet everyone to see it, so it's in there again. So.
I continue to be amazed that, like, Dark Horse hasn't snapped up John to do covers for them or something, because he just does amazing work. But, yeah, it's a beautiful piece of art he did for us. And Adrian's interior art is great, too. So, yeah. For less than $3, it can be yours. And
a bargain.
A bargain at twice the price. So, yeah, thanks for giving me the opening to FimFest, Steve. I appreciate it.
Hey, anytime.
So, hey, we talked about your Fate Core thing earlier. Jason, you want to jump in and talk about that?
Sure. Okay, well, I don't know, you know, but the first version of Arthur Lives, it's kind of a labor of love. It's a project that I have been playing with, tinkering with, ever since I was an undergraduate, which is too many years ago. And when I finally published it, we did it back when Chuck Rice was still in charge of it. And we published it using the 220 system,
mm-hmm.
Which Steve is responsible for. And it was a really great fit. 220 was great for it because it was a very simple and elegant system, and there was a lot of room in 220 for customization. It was,
mm-hmm.
it was very easy to tinker with, and had a lot of it was very easy to sort of move the dials around and adjust things on. Well, anyway, but 220 is unsupported, and quite frankly, not many people played it even when it was supported. And if there was one bit of feedback I got more than anything. On Arthur Lives was, and I quote, "This is such a great game, I'm going to run it in a different system."
Mm-hmm.
So I debated for a long time what system to rewrite it in, and James Dossie, my great editor and publisher over at Vigilance Now, he didn't even know what Arthur Lives was when he got the company. He was sort of going through all the backlog in the product catalog. He saw this book, and it was like selling for $1.99 or something, you know? And he reads over it, it's like 250 pages. And he's like, what is this? And so he called me on the phone one day and says, you wrote this book. And I'm like, yeah, I did. And it's really awesome, and nobody buys it. You know? And so he said, well, what do we have to do to get it out there again? Because we have this wonderful IP kind of idea, you know, what are we going to do with it? So I tinker on a lot of different systems, but honestly, I always wanted to do it in Fate. My problem was that there was no core rulebook for Fate. And so if I wrote on Arthur Lives for Fate, I'd have to reproduce the entire rules for Fate in the book.
Right.
And now we're taking a book that's already fairly large and turning it into a phone book. And quite frankly, I just didn't want to do it.
Yeah. Well, hey, Jason, I personally read Arthur Lives because I used to be at Vigilance Press. But
right, of course you did.
Perhaps some of our listeners haven't, and you could tell them what Arthur Lives is all about.
Sorry, I'm way ahead of myself here. Arthur Lives is a modern magic, urban magic game of Arthurian reincarnations in the present day with a lot of occult investigation and cinematic action. So the players begin by playing regular modern-day characters who are reincarnations of Arthurian myth, but they don't know it. And then during the context of the first two sessions, the characters begin to recognize themselves and the other player characters as Morgana or Lancelot or obscure knight not appearing in this film or whatever.
So, Jason, let me ask you.
Yeah.
How are you going to apply the interesting interactive elements of Fate's character creation system to the in-play process of characters in Arthur's Lives recognizing and remembering these past lives?
Well, in character, so it's a great question. In character creation, in Fate Core, there's like three stages where you think up a previous adventure for yourself, and then you hand your character to a couple of other players, and they add embellishments to that story. So my current version, and I'm only drafting this now, but my current draft, you think of a previous adventure from the myth that you were in. So like, for example, I'm just thinking of this character, and she's I'll pick one of these characters. So she's based on this story called Landfall, which is one of the Lays of Marie de France, and it's this great story about this knight who was all alone and lonely because Arthur has overlooked him and forgotten about him. So Arthur's giving out wives and land, and he forgets poor Landfall and doesn't give him anything. And so Landfall's sitting off alone, and this beautiful woman comes to him out of nowhere and says, well, I just happen to be a very wealthy queen, and I think you're hot, so I'll marry you, but on the condition that you promise not to tell anybody that you're married to me. My existence has to remain a secret. Landfall says, yeah, sure, that sounds like a great deal. So he takes this deal. Well, everything is fine. He becomes popular again because now he's rich. And so all the knights want to hang out with him. And the queen, Guinevere, notices him, and she starts to make a passive. She tries to seduce him. And Lanvol can't get her to go away, and finally he just kind of loses control a little bit, and he brags to her. He says, not only am I already married, but my wife is so beautiful that her handmaidens are more beautiful than you. Well, the queen gets outraged, and she frames Lanvol and says, he tried to seduce me, and Lanvol gets put into prison, where he's forced to stay until, at the very end of the story, his fairy queen shows up and verifies that this is my husband, and then she rides away, and Lanvol jumps at the back of her horse, and they ride off to Apple. The great bit about the story is that it's one in which the woman rescues the man. Lanvol is the damsel in distress in this story, and the princess does all the rescue. Well, anyway, so let's say that a person wants to play that woman, who, of course, like all great Arthurian, is unnamed. So I want to play that woman. Okay, so what do I do? Well, you might come up with a story for what your character did in the myth. Like, since I'm a servant of the Lady of the Lake, I got sent off to Ireland on some diplomatic mission to Alderaan or something. Okay, fine.
That's getting into Arthur in space.
Yeah, which is another thing. Anyway, so you might come up with this adventure. Okay, then what do you do? Then you give that adventure to another member of the group. Like, let's say you got somebody playing Lancelot. You give her to Lancelot, and Lancelot says, oh, well, while you were off in Ireland trying to settle a dispute between these two feuding chieftains, you successfully completed that, but then the chieftains both fell in love with you and started to go to war with each other over you. And I came to your rescue and helped fight them off. And then Lancelot's character writes an aspect on your sheet to represent what you got out of that adventure. Then, finally, the third stage is you have to come up with a present-day connection. So now, shift to the present, where you've got this character who's a lawyer. She's like a defense attorney for guys who have been wrongly convicted. So, she, like Lanvol, she comes to the rescue of people who are in prison for crimes they didn't commit and gets them off.
Mm-hmm.
So now you find a different player. And you come up with so let's say one of the guys, this is on those of you that are watching Vigilance Plus on Facebook, we had a conversation where somebody decided, gave me the idea of playing a King Arthur reincarnation who is also an Elvis impersonator. So you reach out to the guy who's playing the Elvis impersonator King Arthur, who has the wonderful aspect, the once in future King of Rock and Roll, on his character sheet. And you give him your sheet for the defense attorney from Avalon. And he comes up with a story about how you saved him from being convicted of murder when he was thrown into a prison in Salt Lake City after a bar brawl, right? So now you have connections in the myth to one player, but connections in the present to a different player. And these are represented on your character sheet by aspects that you can tag, just like you would tag an aspect in icons.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing, which is not part of fate, but which is part of Arthur Lives, is the idea of a nemesis. Every character in Arthur Lives has a nemesis, even if that nemesis is only other versions of my character. That is, if you're playing a King Arthur reincarnation, this is one of the elements of Arthur Lives, you're not the only reincarnation of King Arthur. King Arthur's soul has been fragmented for reasons that the players do not know, which are detailed in the narrator book. And they've been fragmented so that there are multiple versions of Arthur and Lancelot and Guinevere. The more famous you are, the more versions of you there are. And from a design aspect, I did this so that players didn't feel locked into any one version of a particular character.
Mm.
Well, so the other versions of you are act as a nemesis. But in addition, you pick a nemesis. And often that's usually very clear. You know, in the case of Arthur, it would be Mordred. In the case of, other characters, it's pretty important. Anyway, well, so now you're a nemesis. Who that nemesis is going to be? Well, obviously, she tried to seduce your man and she had him thrown in prison for something he didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
But what if it could be a PC? Guinevere is a traditional... Well, showing PCs is your nemesis, and that has story values as well as combat. So it's designed to create, to play on the interpersonal conflict, which is so deeply rooted in Arthurian myth. I mean, this is a story in which, you know, Gawain and his brothers killed their mother in her own bed because she was with a guy who killed their father.
The original soap opera.
Yeah, yeah. You tell them, oh, you're going to alter Arthurian. They can't think of anything more boring. because the knights are all paladins, you know? They're all, like, white, spotless, clean, super good people that always act the same. What they don't realize is characters have they're very complicated, and they have a lot of qualities that players can really dig into if they want. A lot of time and energy has been spent on this book making it as open as possible to player interpretation and ensuring that players understand that you do not need to play a guy with a lance riding a motorcycle. Which is sort of the default thing people think of when they think of a modern Arthurian knight. Well, I need to go off on a big long story, but it was a good question, so I went off.
Sorry. Hey, no worries. Well, hey, guys, how about we wrap up with talking about pop culture and movies and... Adrian, you've been kind of quiet for a little bit. Have you been reading or seeing anything interesting you want to talk about?
Well, to be honest, I'm slightly out of the loop on comics because my last parcel that was supposedly delivered last month got lost in the post. So I am now 2 months behind comic-wise. So I am now missing Incredible Hulk and Fantastic Four 1, which was last month's releases, which I was very much looking forward to reading. And which is very annoying. been catching up on the stories about... certain threats made to Dan Slott about his treatment of Spider-Man in the last couple of issues of Amazing Spider-Man, which is quite bizarre.
Well, let me definitely go ahead and say spoilers on. If anyone doesn't want to know, go ahead and podcast now. But Steve, Jason, Chris, I'm guessing you guys already know, or do you care if we spoil this for you?
Spoil away.
Okay. Well, I'm not actually buying Amazing, but I tried this. Yes, this 698 was the issue I should have got in my parcel last month, which didn't arrive. So basically, the apparent thing is going on is Dr. Octopus has somehow managed to swap bodies with Peter Parker and is now the Amazing Spider-Man himself, whilst Parker is in a very, very ill, possibly dying body of Doc Ock. So we don't really know where it's going, but everyone pretty much reckons that Parker's going to die and Doc Ock will go on to be the Superior Spider-Man as of next month or whatever's launch of the new Superior Spider-Man title.
And that would be as permanent as, well, everything
in the comics. Basically, probably Peter Parker coming back. I mean, some people have already reckoned that they've worked out a get-out clause that dates back 100 issues. Of getting out of it, so we'll see if anything materializes in that. But I find it odd because if you look at the solicitations for a lot of the Marvel books, Spider-Man apparently is still in the Avengers, even though he's supposed to be stopped up now. So whether or not it's going to impact on the whole Marvel universe as a whole, or it's just going to be contained in four books, I'm not too sure. But
they're going to have to work pretty hard to beat the story where Dr. Octopus proposes to Aunt May.
Well, actually, that's kind of fun because as Peter is in Doc Ock's body, he and Aunt May are supposed to be married, and it's all kind of weird and creepy.
Oh, great.
So, yeah, that's definitely a thing. So, so is anyone still reading DC Comics on this call?
I kind of have to.
Yeah, Chris can't stop reading Flash. He's contracted.
No, I will actually. I unapologetically love the Flash. That's actually one of the accidentally good about the D2, or as I prefer to call it, D2 is impossible because apparently it's 1992 all over again.
Yes.
Does anyone have a reaction to Gail?
It's all good.
It's not about the pouches. Anyone have a response to Gail Simone being fired off of Batgirl, or is that kind of under the bridge at this point?
Well, a surprise.
Yeah, I'm keeping it for an issue or two to see how it pans out, but I've been really enjoying that Batgirl stuff, so it did come out kind of late, so I had no idea what's going on with it. So.
Anyone know why they fired her? The book was apparently selling well and incredibly successful. Anybody?
Well, we don't know a lot, because she hasn't spoken about it too much. She did say that
apparently her proposed story arc to pick up after Death of the Family was completely rejected. Whatever that story was that she pitched was rejected. And then right after that, she was told by email, we're going to let somebody else take over the book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may have been more involved in there, but that's all that I would think of.
So, also, they respect getting every introduction of Ventriloquist and Riddler and a few other old Batman characters in DC as a fangirl. I think Ventriloquist is a fangirl. But obviously, this is going to be from this new guy rather than herself. But, yeah, a bit of an odd one.
There was one Twitter comment where some.
Books. I mean, DC haven't gotten anything else, have they? So, she's not. It's like, even though she's, like, shifted to a different book, so.
Yeah. Somebody tweeted in response to when she revealed that she was off the book. Somebody asked her, what, did you not put enough women in refrigerators for them? And she responded, funny you should say that. So she didn't explain that comment, but I can only presume that that was a factor, that maybe they wanted her to punish a female character she refused or something. I don't know.
Barbara's got a flatmate, so it's possible maybe they tried to kill her, want to kill her off or something with a joke.
Yeah.
Playing on.
Yeah.
Well, in a real sense, at least this way I look at it, isn't Gail Simone like the last writer that should have had anything to do with the new DC? Because as you gentlemen alluded to earlier, the only reason we know that we knew who Gail Simone was to begin with is because she had this devastating critique of gender issues in comics.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
funny enough, don't forget they did actually rehire Rob Liefeld as well. So you know,
and she's now part of a relaunch, which has already made lines like "Let's do it with the masks on," and "My vagina is like a clown car."
Yeah,
and you know, infamous.
Yeah,
and, you know, I mean, really, I mean, she just, you know, it's she just seemed like such an ill fit from this. And even if you go back to her pre-relaunch work, she was working on Secret Six, which was a critically lauded, poorly selling book that DC couldn't run away from fast enough.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, it's almost as like she was a means to an end of making this really awful Batgirl idea work. And credit to her that she made it work as well as it did. I still really don't know why you needed to do that, but I'm a purist. I don't think there needs to be 57 Bat books.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
There is a few too many Bat books, I must say.
Her departure does put her in a kind of wave of prominent departures from DC.
Mm-hmm.
With Morrison and all kinds of people have left now, and most of them have gone to Image. But Gail's been very clear about the fact that she says there's no animosity. She actually says she's not angry. And that she would love to write for DC again, which is not what the other people are saying.
That just points to why I love Gail. Okay,
yeah.
It's up to us fans to go completely out of our minds that these fictional characters aren't treated the way that we think they ought to be. Gail Simone's a professional writer. You don't like my idea? Okay, I'll take it and shop it somewhere else.
Yeah,
the world is
indeed.
Not going to end.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is you can't, you know, and I agree. I mean, you can't you know, get angry at a dog for barking. You know, DC is a corporate entity with very specific goals and needs when it comes to managing their very valuable intellectual property.
Yeah.
And that's what DC's primary interest is as a corporation.
Yeah.
You know, DC's not interested per se in, you know, the individual artistic satisfaction of any one creator.
Right.
You know, they're an IP house, and you know, that's their thing. You know, I think it's noteworthy. It struck me the other day that so much of what DC is focused on these days is the idea of constantly reviving their old IP in some fashion or another. I was struck by the piece of Comic Book News that there's going to be a new version of Captain Carrot as a sort of hard-edged space pirate sort of figure. And it occurred to me that the whole, you know, the whole concept it isn't necessarily a bad one, but why did it have to be Captain Carrot? Why isn't it just a completely new character? When it occurred to me, that's the whole point. It's attaching DC's existing IPs to different things, you know, and from a corporate perspective, DC has no desire to invent new things when it already has things that need to be constantly reinvented.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, the funniest thing I thought is they dropped a lot of the new books that haven't been books in the past for the U52. Frankenstein being one. I mean, I don't remember there being a Frankenstein book. It may have appeared in others. That's obviously been cancelled in a couple of months as well. Blue Beetle's been cancelled again for the third or fourth time now to be replaced with the Threshold book, which Carrot's going to be in. I don't know what they're going to be replaced by. I know we're supposed to be possibly getting a Man of Steel book, which is probably just in time for the movie when that arrives. You're right. Like I say, Phantom Stranger's back. We've got Sword of Sorcery coming back, which is the old Amethyst book, and a lot. They're not bringing new characters in. They're kind of, hey, you remember this from the 70s, or you remember this from the 80s, and that's when they're bringing back into it.
But the interesting thing of it is, you know, I've read the first two issues of Sword of Sorcery, and you know, apart from the very, very high concept of, you know, young woman from Earth who, you know, turns into this fantasy character in this other world, apart from the fact that they share names, this character is nothing like Amethyst.
Oh, no.
You know, and the whole series could have been a completely different book with a completely original character.
Sure.
That some people might have said, oh, yeah, a girl who's a, you know, sword and sorcery hero in another world, that's a little like Amethyst. But other than that, it would have been totally different. But the fact that it's got the Amethyst character name and image sort of layered on top of it is that exact sort of thing of, you know, we're going to keep, you know, breathing new life into these IPs in different ways.
To the corporation, the name represents X many hundred more copies it will sell than if it didn't have.
Well, sure, and it also represents keeping that IP out in print and, you know, keeping that logo around and all of the other elements associated with that.
Yeah.
I'm sending them a proposal for a Captain Compass relaunch. He's a guy who's like a really cool phone with, like, GPS and stuff.
Right?
Yeah. Look for that on your newsstands, folks.
You know what?
It's all ages back, isn't it, of course? That comes from the late 80s, but wasn't it? 70s, 80s, but doing.
Yeah.
Kids everywhere go, what's dialing?
Right.
Dialing
what?
There was a new version of Dial H for Hero, and didn't China Miezo write it?
He's still writing it.
Yes, still is.
Yeah.
I think I've heard once in a while just because it kind of blows your mind every time. It's it is weird and fun. I'd recommend it, but definitely note that I said weird first. And
fun. Yes.
About the, like, launching characters with the same name, but not necessarily being the same character. I mean, we've discussed, like, about Earth 2 when they, like, the Adam Scott thing.
Yeah,
Earth 2 is a perfect example of that.
He's not the Adam Scott from day one. He is another character that just happens to be called Adam Scott, who's now a gay character, and he's also another Green Lantern, but he hasn't had any power sets similar to the original Green Lantern either.
I disagree with you slightly. I think that there are enough of the essential elements, especially his origin, of the classic original Martin O'Dell, Bill Finger Green Lantern. I think it's a very good updating, and I think the fact that they very showily made him gay shouldn't distract from the fact that it really does stay true in I think a lot of important ways to the original concept.
The thing I'm more annoyed about probably than anything else is the fact that they introduced straight away into Earth 2 was the concept of the red and the green, which was really been played out really nicely in Swamp Thing and Animal Man, and they made him an element of the green rather than just being, hey, I'm, you know, I've got powers. You want to, like, retreading the same kind of storylines. Or possibly, well, anyway. You know.
Well, I read an interview with James Robinson, and his take is that he wants Earth 2 to be the world where magic runs wild and reigns supreme. And really, that's one of the ways that you can justify, you know, this is why we really need to have, you know, another Flash and the 57th Green Lantern and things like that. So I think that's a valid updating of the character.
And he has promised to possibly bring back some Infinity characters back, but as a version of the Legion of Superheroes, effectively, for that Earth, which obviously, most of those are unique characters in their own right, rather than, like you say, being another Flash or another Green Lantern and stuff like that, so that'd be quite interesting. But.
Well, hey, the S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show is coming out in fall 2013.
I can't wait!
Cool.
Yeah,
it's got Ming-Na Wen.
I thought you were going to say something about Joss Whedon or Jeff Loeb there, Jason.
No, I
remember. Is it going to be like an Exiles thing, or are we actually going to have proper Marvel heroes and skins in it?
Well, they made that network cancel another show called Strange Desk, which looked like it was kind of an X-Files takeoff, so I'm guessing it's going to be kind of X-Files-esque. With occasional cameos from folks in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah.
So.
That's my understanding as well. I think it's going to be a more of a sort of street-level view of the Marvel Universe from, you know, the side of, you know, what's it like to, you know, work for S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, in this universe where all this other stuff is going on.
Yeah. So does this mean we're going to get a Smallville and Arrow version of every Marvel character that's all angsty and wearing black?
Well, that plus Eliza Dushku can, I guess, move off her mom's couch again. You know, Josh Whedon, I'm sure, will find her some work in there somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, she's a talented actress, Chris.
Actually, that'd be quite cool. I'll give her that.
She is, but I noticed that not a lot of people other than Josh Whedon seemed to want to obsess and cast her in things.
Well, I don't know if that's because Dollhouse didn't do so well, but, you know,
But it could be because Dollhouse Blue?
I say bring back Jewel straight from Firefly to she's only enough, but there you go.
Hey guys, I'm going to ask you a question.
Sure.
Right, oftentimes, whenever you're talking with geeks about comic and movies, it kind of deteriorates into why this stuff sucks. So I'm going to start off with what my dream project would be and go around the room and see what everyone else would like. And what I would like to see, Jason, I interviewed a guy named Ulysses, what's his last name, Paras?
Ulysses
Theranos?
Yeah.
Yeah, he does amazing work. He had a pinup on his DeviantArt page that was the Justice Society of America fighting the, like, 1930s Martian invasion.
Yeah.
Which just looked amazing. I would love to see that actually made into an Elseworlds, or, because, 1930s, I think, are great for those characters. Fighting an alien invasion is a great setting for superheroes, so... That's the thing I'd love to see DC do. And Jason, I'll hand it off to you. What's your dream project that you would love to see someone?
I thought you were going to ask me what I get to write, and I was all set.
Well, you can do that too.
No, that's all right. Well, I would love to write something for Masterminds one day, Steve. If you ever.
I'm not the guy in charge of that anymore, but.
You are?
Let's do that. No, that's, you have to talk to John Lighthouser about that. He's the developer these days.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, fair enough. All right, missing though, what would I like to see? Gosh. I would like to see, I would have, 6 months ago, I would have said a version of the Scarlet Witch that doesn't suck, but they're giving me that now in the new Uncanny Avengers, so I'm going to consider that one a done deal, and instead I'm going to ask for a version of Doctor Doom that doesn't suck. I'm a big fan of Doom, going back to his earliest roots, and he's kind of been run roughshod a lot, and I would love to see, like, here we go, let's give it a specific. I want to see a return of supervillain team-up. With Dr. Doom as the main, as the protagonist, and then a guest-starring supervillain of the month. That's what I want.
That's a pretty cool idea. Adrian, how about you?
Okay, this is massively biased on my side, but I want a Captain Britain series. Because I am a massive Captain Britain fan, and every time he ceases to appear in something, the book gets cancelled within 3 months of it being appearing. So I would like a Captain Britain series drawn by Alan Davis, possibly written by Cornell or anybody that's I don't care, right? As long as it's good, Captain Britain.
I'd put down good money for that.
Yeah.
MI-13 lasted almost a year, Captain Britain.
Captain, yeah, they're too bad, yeah. And he was in Secret Avengers for a while, literally a month after my council the book, so that's a bit sucky, but, yeah.
Well, hey, let's go to Chris and finish up with Steve.
Okay, I'm picking a dream comic project. Is that it?
Well, especially you, because you're kind of like a huge commission. And don't get me wrong, I love you for it, Chris, but what would you would love to see that make you feel joy in your dark side?
That's right. What would make your heart grow three sizes, Chris?
You mean other than Dan DiDio and all those other 90s rejects of Marvel going off and becoming monks or something?
Yeah, out of it.
Okay. I tell you what I would kind of like to see that might actually fit into the current zeitgeist over with geeks and over at DC is that right now we seem to be at the point now where, you know, the really 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 outstanding stuff that's being done seems to have a fair, you know, almost a nihilistic streak to it, you know, like, and the first thing on top of my mind is The Walking Dead. You know, you tune into The Walking Dead to see which beloved character is going to be disemboweled in front of your eyes. And you know,
have you heard the comic, Chris?
I read the first issue because it was free online. Okay. I took a vow in 1992 to never actually buy an Image comic. And I don't go back on my vows easily. So I will never actually buy an Image comic, but number one was free for online. I read it and enjoyed it. And that actually made me want to watch the show.
Okay,
but, you know,
sounds comics, because you could get around it by doing that.
No, Image will never get a dime from me.
Ah, okay.
No, but the thing is, you know, you watch them die, and it means something, because, you know, in the Walking Dead universe, comic or TV, these people aren't coming back. There isn't going to be a magical reset button where, you know, like, oh, Scarlet Witch brought me back, or some crap like that.
Hey, now.
or made me go away for it to begin with. Not that Marvel would ever do that. But... Okay, what I would like to see DC do is, and they're kind of halfway there with this multiversity title that Grant Morrison is doing.
Yeah.
I would love to see a continuing title set on Earth X and showing a bunch of incredibly desperate heroes fighting against this horrific worldwide Nazi tyranny, knowing the odds are completely against them, and that, you know, if one of them dies in a horrible, horrible fashion, they're probably not coming back. And doing a very grown-up, maybe sort of a Battlestar Galactica reboot sort of take on grim issues of survival and sacrifice, and what do you do? You know, what are you willing to do in the name of survival? At what point do you cease to be worthy of survival? And it could be violent and naughty and thing and controversial, and that seems to be all the things DC is into these days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might only run for six issues before it just bums everybody the heck out. But, you know, I would love to see a story where the heroes are truly up against it, and you know that there isn't going to be some magical reboot at the end, or, you know, you get to flip the cover back over and say, oh, it was just an Elseworlds. It doesn't really matter. You know, so something with a little more grown-up stakes to it.
Oh, cool.
There you go.
All right, you sound like the guy who wrote Golden Age, Mutants and Masterminds or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just thinking that would make a really interesting superhero RPG campaign.
It would be pretty cool, yeah.
If only we knew people who were publishing this.
Oh, no.
Well, I do have a prize. I'm a public educator. I know I'm rolling fat, but I can be bought.
Okay, well, hey, last but not least, Mr. Kenson.
I think that my dream project would be for all of the 70-plus-year-old comic book characters to fall into the public domain.
Yeah.
So that we could see all kinds of different takes where people could take and remix Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman and Alan Scott's Green Lantern, and we could see everybody's take on those characters. It wouldn't be, you know, just, well, this is DC's approved version of the IP this month.
Well, that would have to happen at some point, right?
Well, if none of Disney has their way, it won't.
Oh, hell no.
Because as long as Mickey Mouse is older than Superman, you know, I think that you're going to be in for a good fight on copyright for quite some time yet to come.
And they do have deep pockets, don't they?
Yeah, indeed.
So, okay, well, cool. That's a good way to end things on. Everybody's talking about positive stuff they like or would like to see. That doesn't happen often, so. All right, guys, well, we can go ahead and call it a podcast. Anything else you want to mention before we sign off?
It was a real pleasure to be invited. Thank you so much.
Yes, indeed.
Merry Christmas to everyone.
Yes. Happy holidays to everybody.
Happy Hanukkah and blessed solstice. And all the wonderful holiday wishes to everybody.
Right.
A festive Kwanzaa and a happy Festivus to all of you.
Indeed.
Festivus for the rest of us.
Now, the airing of the grievances.
I just thought he did that. I think that was the last hour.
Followed by the feats of strength. Adrian, anything you'd like to kick in before we call it off?
No, that's it. That's my wishes of everybody to have a happy Christmas and a positive and eventful new year.
Nice. All right. Well, hey, folks, thanks for tuning in. And until next time, my horrible and deplorable sign-off is, make mine BAMF. And everybody take it easy.